Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Film, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran, and I'm thrilled to be here today with Catherine Russell, author of The Cinema of Barbara Stanwyck, 26 Short Essays on a Working Star, published in 2023 by the University of Illinois Press. Catherine Russell is a distinguished university research professor of cinema at Concordia University in Montreal. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. Nice to be here, and thank you so much for inviting me to talk about my book.
I can't wait to talk about your book and Barbara Stanwyck. So I read the whole book, and I read the essays out of order, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. You come across as, I mean, you are the uber fan of Barbara Stanwyck. Mere mortals like me think, oh yeah, I'm a big admirer of Barbara Stanwyck. And then I read this book, and I'm like, wow, this is the uber fan. So let's start there, and let's start with the title. In what ways was Barbara Stanwyck a true working star?
Well, she was a hard worker, and she earned a reputation for being a very highly professional person on sets, and it really earned her a lot of respect amongst crews and directors and cast members, and this is over a 60-year career. And that's part of it. She worked hard, and I also wanted to shift the focus from the actress as an icon or an image to issues of labor. And Stanwyck was never attached to any particular studio, and so she was a freelance worker most of her career. She'd have short contracts with many, many different studios and constantly renegotiating them. And so, good acting actually makes labor invisible. And it was important to me to separate her from her image and look at her as a woman who has agency and actually played a role in the industry as well as roles on screen.
Yeah, it's hard to watch a Barbara Stanwyck movie and not think of her as Barbara Stanwyck. Is that, you know what I'm saying? Like, you can't watch Cary Grant and not think of him being Cary Grant, so to speak, right? So let's go into the bigger question then. There's a lot of subjects you could have chosen, right? Why does she fascinate you? I mean, I imagine you had to live with Barbara Stanwyck for a long time to do a deep dive like this. I mean, she made close to 100 films. So what is it about Barbara Stanwyck that makes you say, all right, I'm going to take the plunge now and really go deeply into this subject?
Well, I'm a fan like you are, like many people are. So, if you're going to spend a lot of time with somebody, Barbara's is a good choice. From a scholarly perspective, I was interested in her because she's so full of contradictions. And I wanted to kind of unpack those contradictions, starting from the fact that, you know, she looks tough, she's strong, she has become a feminist icon. There's a lot of speculation about her sexuality. And yet she really doesn't in her personal life conform to any of those ideals. You know, she was a Republican. I find that she's a bit homophobic when challenged on that issue. She was straight. She was conservative. And yet she still managed to shift the terms of femininity over the course of her career through the roles she chose and through her performance style and so on. So I find that a really interesting contradiction. And really why I got on to her is because I wanted to write about a book about Hollywood. It seems like a weird thing to say, but I've written books about many different things, and I really wanted to get into Hollywood. I'm a cinephile. I've been teaching Hollywood for a long time, and I found that her career provided such a great roadmap through the industry and through great films and also through lesser known films, you know, which are important to me. And she kind of served as a lever or a wedge that with which I could open up the story of Hollywood and try and look at it from a woman's perspective, because we don't have, you know, like there's not enough directors. And so people say, oh, we can't do that. Well, yes, we can, you know, and I think she contributed as much as any director to the overall image and feel of Hollywood as a cultural industry.
That's a great point about her image and that how hard it is to pin down, and how, and your book makes you realize how much it changed. And it's funny, a new question just popped in my mind when you were speaking is that, of all the images that could have been chosen for the cover of your book, this is really interesting, right? Because you would think it would be a picture of her as Phyllis Dietrichson or in The Lady Eve or these, you know, but I this was come from the cover of Parade magazine, right? Can you talk a little about the cover image for our listeners and how it was arrived at?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was not actually, as far as I can tell, linked to any particular shoot, you know, it's 1955. She wears a similar outfit in 40 Guns.
I thought which it was 40 Guns.
Yeah, but this is earlier than that. Yeah. I found it in an archive, and you know, it seemed I basically shot a photograph of it because it was so unique. And then, you know, researching it, we found that it hadn't really appeared anywhere. And it's nice to have an image that isn't. Right. Familiar image.
Right.
And the photographer is sort of has disappeared. It was really difficult to find any of his heirs or anything. I mean, that's a story that somebody else can follow up on, is like, who is this guy and how did he come to shoot such a fantastic photo? I have no idea. But Parade magazine was an insert. So it was in all of the, you know, like municipal papers. I found it in a Texan newspaper, you know, but no, I found it in the archive, but that's where it was from, the El Paso Times. So. Yeah.
So our listeners can go on the website and see the image or see it wherever you get the book. But it was funny because that image reminded me of how versatile she was as an actor, right? Because she, like, this does not look like the same person who might be in The Lady Eve or you know, other movies like that. So it was like, I thought it was such an interesting choice of cover.
Yeah, thanks.
So let's talk about the structure of your book, which is also very interesting and not what I would expect and not what a lot of readers would expect. It's what you call an ABC diary.
Uh-huh.
And you point out at the very beginning that there are many biographies of Stanwyck. You have a great line. You say, all of them reverent and idolatrous. Right at the beginning, reverent and idolatrous. So talk about what makes your book different and why you made the decision to not write another straight biography.
Well, my book is different. It is a scholarly work, and I draw on a lot of feminist theory and so on. So that's why it's not hagiography. I'm not trained as a biographer. I didn't want to write a biography. I find that taking a non-linear approach is a way of opening things up and looking at things from different perspectives and put different parts of her career side by side to make the interesting kind of connections. And, you know, it took me a while to come up with this. In French, it's called abécédaire. So it's a more familiar term perhaps in French. And it's a kind of a classical style of bookmaking, I think. And it really helped me to organize all. I'd been researching for years and I had all these notes and I had to figure out how to put them together. And, you know, having chapters with letters as the title is a really arbitrary, random way of organizing things, but it enabled me to pick up the themes I was interested in, you know, like riding and stunts, for example, and also the films that I wanted to focus on, like Stella Dallas and No Man of Her Own, and the people whose paths she crossed with, you know, and like Edith Head and Fred McMurray. And so it's a bit of a random way of going about things. But I do kind of cross-reference if you're, you know, because different films will turn up in different chapters. And so I have a little handy referencing way in case you want to follow up on different ideas yet.
And I read the essays out of order, and it seems to me that that would be something you would actually endorse.
Oh, totally, totally. I wrote them in order just because it was a good way of getting through the project, you know, most of which happened during the pandemic. And I was like, what'll I do this week? You know, I'll write, you know, chapter R. And so I don't like to read it in order because I find it like my thinking goes. But so I think it's better if people read them out of order and find connections that maybe I even missed.
Great. So I thought our listeners would enjoy hearing your take on some of her most famous films. And they're, you know, the films that drew a lot of us to Barbara Stanwyck. So I want to start with those. So let's start with Double Indemnity, Billy Wilder, 1944. You actually say in this chapter, at some point in this chapter, like every single second of this film has already been analyzed, you know, backwards and forwards, right? But this is in the C chapter for Crimes of Passion. And you use Walter Benjamin's idea, and Walter Benjamin comes up in your book a lot. You use Walter Benjamin's idea of the destructive character to talk about Phyllis, which is the role that Barbara Stanwyck plays there. So what I want to ask you is, what is a destructive character, and how does that whole idea help us better appreciate Phyllis and what Stanwyck does with that role?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. But first of all, I just want to point out that Walter Benjamin wrote The Arcades Project, which is an abecedary.
Oh, good.
just pointing that out. And the destructive character, I wanted to use that idea of a dangerous woman because this was a really a new iteration of the new woman. She embodied the new woman of the 30s, along with many other actors, right? And that was a sort of the sexy depression era babyface new woman. But now we're in 1943, and it's a new woman, and it's a much more a different kind of modernity. It's she's an anti-heroine. She is a dangerous woman who's been mystified as a femme fatale, which femme fatale is always meaning like that's really about the man. No, what about her? You know, and I'm following here other feminist theorists, and they've been. A number of other theorists have rethought this figure as a tragic character, and it's a role normally given to men in literary and film studies. But Phyllis Dietrichson is a character in her own right. And for Stanwyck herself, it took a lot of courage for her to take on this role because it was really unprecedented, you know, to be a bad woman at this point. After all, she was a bad baby face, you know, Lily was a bad woman way back when. But after playing all these maternal roles in the late 30s, it was a big move for her. And, it was Billy Wilder who convinced her to do it. I think she plays it as a kind of a form of satire. And again, if you think of a baby face, it's not unlike the baby face character who also wore a wig, right? And the wig and the sunglasses make it a very different kind of performance. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's groundbreaking. It was a totally new type of performing, as well as a new kind of character. And it kind of signals the death of the more progressive women of the 30s and points forward to the paranoid women of the 30s. And, you know, Phyllis Dietrichson is far from paranoid. And she's in total control of the narrative, you know, it's her story. And the men at the end of the film can't figure out what the hell happened to them, you know, she dies, and thus she's a tragic figure. And she's dangerous to the status quo. She's dangerous to the patriarchy.
Yeah, straight down the line.
Oh, yeah.
Straight down the line, as she says. Well, you just reminded me when you talked about her as a tragic figure and about the wig and the sunglasses, it's that, you know, in the whole film, Phyllis, you know, you have Barbara Stanwyck playing Phyllis, but Phyllis is also playing this other version of herself, right? That she's always, like, Phyllis Dietrichson is always on stage. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a theme that runs throughout the book of her playing double characters. Thelma Jordan is another, you know, film noir. No Man of Her Own is another version of that. And these sort of nested performances that Stanwyck really excelled in my view.
Yeah. I recently saw The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, and that's another, like, it's like a little, like a Russian stacking doll where there's the actor and the performance and trying to pretend. And so that's a great point. I never thought of that. So let's move on. Well, actually, let's move backwards in time to The Lady Eve, Preston Sturges, 1941. Now, this is in the L chapter, and you call The Lady Eve an especially good example of the threat of a woman's power. So you also point out that many viewers see Hopsy, who's the Henry Fonda, you know, rube, so to speak, in the film, that many people see him as the hero. So I want to go back to that quotation. What specifically does Eve and Stanwyck threaten? And then how does that threat play out?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, she's a threat, again, to the social order and the patriarchy. And her threat is the power of performance. You know, she basically plays two women, in this case, very overtly two women. And she dupes her love interest, the Henry Fonda character, but she doesn't dupe us as the audience at all. And it's this ability to shapeshift and manipulate men that she uses to basically crash the class system and stage manage her own story. And, you know, the end of the film, I know my own reading of it is somewhat idiosyncratic because I feel like the ending completely undermines the narrative when I sort of say, who would marry a man who doesn't even recognize you, you know? And so Sturges gives her this fantastic script, but at the end of the day, it's Hopsy who wins her and certainly appeared to critics of the time as the hero of the story. And like, again, I want to say, you know, shift the focus and say, no, wait a second, who's the hero here? She's the one who, again, stage managed it and had agency as a character throughout the entire film.
Yeah, and especially in the second half, like you said, she literally stage manages the whole return to Hopsy. You also just reminded me that Hopsy is a lot like Walter, right? Is that like Walter in Double Indemnity? Is that neither man can imagine that they're being manipulated by this person they thought they were superior to? Because Walter thinks he's got her, he's calling her baby the whole time and lighting the matches with the thumb. And Henry Fonda, so to speak, you know, he thinks, well, I'm morally better than you, right?
Yeah.
And then she flips everything on him.
Exactly,
as well.
Exactly. So, you know, and the story of the Lady Eve is a gold digger type of story. You know, she's looking for class mobility, you know, and there's a famous line at the beginning, let us not be commoners, you know, crooks, but not commoners. And she successfully, you know, breaks through, but strictly by conning her way through.
Yeah. Do you think, and then do you think that the fun of the film is when Preston Sturges makes that character say, well, however, what would happen if she actually developed feelings for her mark?
that is what happens basically. Right. And so she does develop feelings for him. But does he develop feelings for her? Not clear. He doesn't know who she is. Doesn't recognize her at all.
Right.
So it's like so absurd.
Right.
Anyway, yeah.
Which is also funny why, because now you have me thinking about this movie a lot. That's where all the, I think, that we're like on her side, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
So that's why all the laughs are so good on the train where she starts going through her resume of all her past loves and everything. And he's so shocked, but we're laughing with her.
Yeah.
And he's horrified by her, right?
Yeah. And he's the fall guy, literally.
Yeah. Yeah, literally, he falls in the beginning right when she trips him. Excellent. So let's go further back in time, one more, to 1937 in King Vidor's Stella Dallas. Now, you point out that this film has received more scholarly attention than any other of Stanwyck's films, and you bring up the question of the degree, and I this was probably my favorite chapter and the favorite thing you do in the whole book. You bring up the degree to which Stella knows what she's doing as she goes throughout the film, because I think that's it's a very, very gray area if you watch Stella Dallas, right? You also review some of the debates about the film. So let's talk about her for a minute. What is your take on Stella Dallas? I know it's a big question, right? But someone says to you, like, well, how much does she know what's going on? Like, what's the movie really about? Like, talk about that.
Well, you know, the reason it was such an important film for feminist criticism was because it foregrounded the question of identification, you know, and some feminists said we identify with her, a woman who has to make this big sacrifice. And other people sort of say, no, we identify with all of the the women in the film, and who see the impossible kinds of decisions and contradictions that women have in patriarchy. And then it was actually Stanley Cavell who suggested that actually maybe Stella knows what she's doing, you know, and maybe she's just play acting again all the time. And my take is basically that we can't, there's no knowledge. This is a fictional character. You know, does she know or does she not know? It's the inscrutability that Stanwyck embeds in this performance. And she actually said when she really wanted the role, and one of the reasons she wanted, she says, well, I get to play two women, you know? She gets to play two women. One knows, one doesn't know. And she's not going to reveal. It's this kind of interior contradiction within her performance. And so I'm just pointing out that all this fuss and all this discussion about does she know or doesn't she know and who do we identify with? Well, she makes herself to be very difficult to identify with, even though she's a completely sympathetic character. But we don't know her decision-making process because she's not going to tell us. And this was something that she brought to the film completely independently. And, you know, that was her contribution to the whole film. And so that's why it has become such an important film.
Yeah, we're not privy to her decision-making process. And in a lesser performance or a lesser film, because the whole film is unbelievably great, in a lesser film, the scene where she overhears her daughter on the train and starts weeping, and that's supposed to be, the moment. But you can also watch the soda shop scene where she barges in and you almost can't believe. You're like, is Barbara Stanwyck overdoing it? Is Stella overdoing it? Is Barbara Stanwyck trying to play somebody who doesn't know she's overdoing it? And every time you think you grab the answer, something else happens.
Yeah. And just before the soda pop scene, she crosses the golf course and this guy, these gay guys, and they sort of make a gesture like that refers to kind of something gay, which signals to me, this is drag. She's, you know, Stella Dallas is doing drag. So, you know, there's a completely different way of reading it, but it's like she's in total control.
Yeah, she's in so let's talk. What do you make of the ending then? If she's in total control, like, and she watches the, you know, the wedding ceremony through the bars, and she walks away. I mean, that could have been one reading when the film came out, but how do you read that moment now?
She's proud and free. Yeah. I mean, why not? Why not? But she's also missing her daughter. You can have two things at once. That's the thing, you know? And just because she sacrificed her daughter doesn't mean she won't be live happily ever after as a single woman, does it? So, she's a fictional character. She doesn't have to be either way. She can register both.
Yeah, that's great. Because if the film went on for five more minutes, it might start to answer its own questions. And that's what's great about where it ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So, you know, we talked about what Stella wears. You talked about her on the golf course. And that's some of the debate around Stella revolves around what she wears. And you have a chapter on Edith Head, who everybody knows, you know, who Edith Head was. She designed the costumes for 24 of Stanwyck's films, although ironically not Stella Dallas. But you raised the idea that Edith Head dressed Stanwyck in different ways to match the different stages of her career. I thought that was all new to me, their relationship. So talk about their relationship and how she dressed Stanwyck.
Well, I mean, their relationship is fairly well known in the sense that when they started working together on Lady Eve, they'd done one previous film previously, but Lady Eve, it set both of their careers on fire. It did as much for Edith Head as it did for Stanwyck. And Stanwyck had really avoided being glamorous up until then. She kind of identified with the sort of luxe cosmetics, natural girl. But then when she's after the Lady Eve, she's in the Ball of Fire and Double Indemnity, also dressed by Edith Head. These women are a little bit sleazy. And, you know, that's a very special way of dressing that's still sympathetic characters, you know, in a time when these women were, you know, sleazy women were not normally looked upon well. I mean, overall, I think, you know, she's, Stanwyck had a fairly butch, tough persona, and Edith had really helped her cultivate a feminine image that was still tough, and that's what the sleaziness comes in. And this is both on screen and off. So Stanwyck hired Head to make her everyday outfits, you know, for going out, which is important, you know. Until they met, she didn't dress like a movie star. And then I think in the 1940s, when Head does some outfits for her for the Westerns, like the Furies, and Stanwyck is wearing trousers. Well, here it gives her an opportunity to be, you know, an older woman, still a star and still fashion forward, because, you know, trousers was like, again, the new woman, you know, all invented all over again. And then Stanwyck gave her jeans again, you know, for the Roustabout film in 1964 with Elvis Presley. And so, you know, there's ways in which they evolve together in important kinds of ways.
Yeah, that's something that people would take for granted, but that's a great point. And again, you're making me realize a lot of things that sleaziness is a great word for Phyllis, right? How do you address sleaziness? And I wonder if original viewers of that film when it came out, is it possible for us to even respond to her in the same way as a Wilder's original audience?
No, not necessarily. It's hard to say. I've never seen any commentary from women, except that there is some fans who admired her decision, you know, to be a bad girl and to play this kind of this woman who's like usually the butt of the joke, right? And to make her into a sympathetic character. So it was a bold move, but women went along with it.
Yeah, that's terrific. So something also brand new to me was the chapter on the Barbara Stanwyck Show, which was a TV show of hers that ran on NBC for one season, 1960 to 1961. Now, this show featured Stanwyck and recognizable stars and in standalone melodramas. You point out that it's on Amazon, and it is, and our listeners can go check it out. But rather than gush over it, you note that Stanwyck, you say she couldn't come down. That's your phrase. She couldn't come down to the small screen. And here's what you call it. You call it a melodrama of missed opportunity and too-latedness.
Yeah.
So talk about that.
I didn't gush over the show, but I really think it's great, and I highly recommend watching
it. You talk about
a few
episodes, I'm sorry, that are really great, yeah.
And again, my analysis kind of focuses on the contradictions that are embedded in it. And by not being able to come down, I mean that they're referring to these like introductions that she does. And it's like she never learned or was never directed to do direct address. And everybody was television. You talk to the camera and you're intimate, you know, everybody, even Hitchcock could do it, you know. And she either didn't want to, I don't know what the reasoning was, but she's kind of in these very stilted poses and sort of maintained the glamorous, ironically, given that she never wanted to be glamorous. So, you know, that's sort of the kind of missed opportunity that I was talking about. But also, that it was canceled after only one season, and she got an Emmy for Best Actress in a TV show, and then they canceled it. There was supposed to be a spin-off pilot in which she plays Josephine Little, I think, and like she's in Hong Kong and really interesting character. That didn't go anywhere. It was like it had so much potential, and she, you know, had so many contacts to make it a great show, big network. And so all the co-actors, like the anthology drama show, she had all kinds of different stars working with her. And, you know, it gave her a lot to work with, in my opinion, much more than The Big Valley, which did turn out to be her big successful TV show. Or she's very limited in that series to one character, one long story. So it was a really, really, it was a missed opportunity. And the other thing to say about it is the stories are these great setups, but then they always end up in like very contained way, you know, and she plays these strong, powerful women, but somehow she ends up married in the end and living happily ever after. So it's another kind of missed opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. And more contradictions.
More contradictions. Exactly.
So your H chapter, let's move on to H, named after William Holden. And he made two films with Stanwyck. And you talk about the rumors that he and Stanwyck had an affair, but that's not what really interests you, or at least that's the sense I got when I read it. It's Holden's age in relation to Stanwyck's and the ages of other men with whom she worked or even twice married. And you talk about her talent for, and this is your phrase, making men. So let's talk about that. What was her talent for making men, and what do you make of these age disparities?
Well, I mean, part of it was that there was so little recorded. So we know very little about how actors learn to act in the studio era. You know, Stanwyck learned on, like, by doing, you know, in New York on Broadway. But some, William Holden and Robert Taylor and many others, Robert Wagner, they're like thrown in and say, you know, sink or swim. And Barbara would take mercy on them and help them, coach them, and you know, help them get along in front of cameras and learn the craft of movie making by performing with them and sort of being a buffer between them and the director sometimes. And so, you know, I'm saying that there's all this gossip. Who knows, you know, whether she and Holden had an affair. I mean, yes, she married Robert Taylor. Yes, she had an affair with Robert Wagner some years later. But whether, you know, I think it's important to kind of cut through that gossip, that level of gossip that is recorded. That's all we know from the trade magazines, you know, and think about skill sharing. And, you know, it could extend to other couples and other kinds of friendships within the industry, the way that actors may have helped themselves and taught each other how to act. I mean, the other half of the story is that Stanwyck was so well paid and always got top billing. She often was paired with actors who weren't that great and were just learning. And, you know, yes, she did some films with Gary Cooper and Henry Fonda a couple of times, but did she ever get a chance to work with Jimmy Stewart? No, you know, and so because her salaries were so big. Anyway, so she got matched a lot of the time with lesser paid actors. I mean, even Fred McMurray, who's not a great actor, he's great when he's with her, got paid less than her, you know? Right. And this was, so she has, in order to get people up to her level, she's had to coach them in a sense.
There's that cliche in sports that worse teams play better when they play really good teams.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of like that. But in, you know, the history of Hollywood, all you get is like gossip, and you go through the fan magazines. You would never know any of this. Nobody asked them any questions. Nobody thought about what they gave to each other in terms of collaborators.
Did you come across anything at all in all your research and just your lifetime of fandom for Barbara Stanwyck about what directors thought about her, like as somebody to work with, or what her other people on the set thought about her? Like, it seems to me like people really enjoyed working with her. Is that true?
Oh yeah, they routinely loved her. Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't know of any that really she didn't get along with. But you know, didn't mean they got to work over and over again with her, unfortunately, because they didn't have that kind of control, and she didn't. I mean, Billy Wilder, you know, managed to get her, you know, in Ball of Fire, because he had that kind of pull at the time. But like I said, he wanted her. Like, everybody wanted to work with her. So, yeah, that was the thing. I mean, even Sam Fuller, apparently Paramount wanted Marilyn Monroe to be in 40 Guns. And Fuller said, no, 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 no.
It would have been a much different movie.
Oh, yeah.
So, let's go. We could go through all the other chapters of your book, if we all 26 of them. But you have one time, you know, gambling. You have one on her voice, which I thought, like, Barbara Stanwyck's voice, which is so, like, so distinctive, right? One about American history. And you said before you planned them out, which was a surprise to me. Like, I imagined you wrote these out of order. But my question now is, what's one of the chapter ideas that that you would have never imagined, you know, if you had a time machine to go back, like, you would have said, I would have never thought I'd get a whole chapter out of, like, what?
Well, I enjoyed writing all of the chapters, but the chapter on Teresa Harris, I guess, surprised me the most, and it actually has become a standalone essay. I kind of expanded it because it grew once I scratched the surface. Teresa Harris is the actor who plays Chico, the maid, in Babyface. And she appears again as a singer in Banjo on My Knee. And she plays maids in so many films. Her career is like her career goes up to 1953 or 1954, but there's 103 titles there, mostly maids. And I found that she was in so many films, like Lady from Shanghai, Out of the Past, Jezebel, I Walked with a Zombie. It also turns out she went to university and went to acting school and, you know, had more training than Stanwyck ever did. And it just was really interesting to see when you look at Black characters and you shift the focus and put them in the foreground. And teaching cinema these days, this is what students do all the time. And I was really happy to find a way of doing that and look at Harris's career as a star of the archive. Once you see her, once you recognize her, and then you sort of look at the films differently from her perspective, and kind of imagine what the backstory of that person, that character she plays, might be, you know, things take on a slightly different tinge and really you get slightly different readings of it. So, of the film. So, like I say, that it was a fun chapter to write, and so much that I expanded it. I had too much material to fit into one chapter, and of course her career goes on much bigger than her few films with Stanwyck, for sure. But Chico's a pretty amazing character.
Yeah, absolutely. So we mentioned, you know, Babyface, Double Indemnity, Stella Dallas, Lady Eve, the famous ones. But I have to ask this for our last question. What are some lesser known Stanwyck films that you would recommend, that you would say, I've seen them all, here's one you haven't seen, or two or 10. What are some movies that we should watch?
Yeah, we've already mentioned quite a few. I mean, The Furies is a great one. Anthony Mann Western. All I Desire. She made two films with Douglas Sirk. I have a certain fondness for There's Always Tomorrow with Fred McMurray. It's one of my all-time favorites. The early 30s with the Capra films, Ladies of Leisure, The Miracle Woman, fantastic film. Thelma Jordan and No Man of Her Own are film noirs that maybe not everybody knows. I mean, every film has something to offer. Jeopardy with Ralph Meeker, directed by John Sturges. Whoa. Mid-50s, I guess. And it's really remarkable, like, even, you know, the most poorly written and directed drivel that she does. She had to do sometimes. She would sign these three film contracts and she couldn't say no to them, but she still shines. She still makes it worth watching, you know, just because of her performance. Maybe the last one is her very last TV miniseries performance at Thornbirds, in which she's 76 years old and playing a woman of that age. And with Richard Chamberlain, just incredible scenes they have together. Yeah, very powerful.
Yeah, that's a great list. But I want to go back to one, if I can indulge you for another minute, another film on your list. You said There's Always Tomorrow with Frederick Murray, right? And I only saw that because a friend of mine said, you have to see There's Always Tomorrow. And I said, I've never seen that. He said, you've got to see it today. And it's a terrific, terrific film. So can you mentioned how much you love that film. What is it about that film? I'm so curious that's on your list.
Well, I mean, their pairing together is really interesting. They mimic each other. I have some frame enlargements in the book, and it's amazing. The design of it is nice. I mean, it's not Edith Head, but Stanwyck plays a fashion designer, and again, it's a way she has control over the narrative in a very sort of double-ish way, you know. And this little commentary on fashion. It's Cirque, so there's the way that the ensemble acting works is great. Joan Bennett is amazing, and it's a really interesting story of the 1950s also, and there's all these like parallels with All That Heaven Allows. You know, the teenagers who don't want their father to have an affair, you know, like they want to control things because they're uppity teenagers, 1950s teenagers, and they're really nasty. but she blows them off, you know, she talks them down, like, so yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's great. So, Catherine, it's been great talking with you today. I could go through the whole book and through all 100 movies, but in the interest of time, we'll stop here. The Cinema of Barbara Stanwyck, 26 Short Essays on a Working Star, is available wherever books are sold. You can also get a copy linked from the New Books Network website. This was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Catherine Russell.
Thank you so much.